Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, February 24th, 2011. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. But this week, so you want a lager, but you don't want to buy a chest freezer? Chris Colby and I go over some alternate strategies to keep your fermenter chilly. If you're new to home brewing or would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Basic Brewing, all one word. You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. Also, we have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video show page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show, and we appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. And we have Basic Brewing iPhone and Android podcast apps on their respective stores. And we're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, too. Well, Chris and I will talk a little bit more about this in a few minutes, but I want to let you know that we are already receiving data from the current BYO-BBR collaborative experiment on starch conversion. The deadline is Monday, so don't forget us if you brew an all-grain or partial mash batch between now and then. Let's look into the mailbag. The issue of preheating grains is still generating some comments. This one comes from veteran homebrewer Joel. Joel says, I found the discussion about preheating grist interesting. As a garage brewer, I noticed this factor does matter in the winter. Brewing software can account for this, but bringing things like the grist and even the tun indoors before brew days saves propane. In addition to the grain, I think the thermal sink of a cold tun is an important factor. I really appreciated hearing from an open-minded and relatively new homebrewer. After homebrewing for 16 years, I've found the fun is in listening to the new guys and increasingly gals. Thanks, Joel. It's good advice. Warm up the mash tun by bringing it inside if you've got it in the garage, and your grain, too. And it's good to hear that even after 16 years of brewing, you're still open to listening to new ideas. And I think that that's key to improving our beers, even if we've been in it for a while. Here are some thoughts on the subject from Sean Terrell, who you've heard on this show, with his experiments with starters and with his efforts to design a more accurate formula to correct refractometer readings taken post-fermentation or post-fermentation. Sean says, I also wanted to weigh in on the discussion of heating grains prior to the mash that's been going on the past few weeks. Personally, I don't see the need, and so I haven't tried it. With accurate measurements of grain and water temperature and the liquor-to-grist ratio, it should be pretty trivial to hit mash temperatures precisely. I've often wondered if the majority of home brewers aren't using a thermometer that's significantly inaccurate. Like any instrument, calibration is key. But temperatures are harder to calibrate at home than most things. If nothing else, it's probably worth it to check any thermometer used in brewing against ice water every half dozen brew sessions or so. And what Sean's talking about is if you take a mixture of 50-50 mixture of ice and water and measure that temperature, it should be 32 degrees Fahrenheit or 0 degrees Celsius. And if your thermometer isn't reading that, that may be an issue. Sean continues, chemically, I don't think there would be any risk associated with heating the malts while they're dry. Caramelization reactions don't occur below 110 degrees Celsius or 230 degrees Fahrenheit, and Maillard reactions don't proceed very well in dry malts below about 10% moisture, according to Declercq. Essentially, all you would be doing is extending the dry kilning phase of malting, albeit at a very low temperature. Even pale malts are kilned at 80 degrees Celsius or so for several hours, so a few minutes at 70 degrees Celsius shouldn't have any perceptible impact on color or the formation of Maillard products, including melanoidins. I doubt that denaturing of enzymes would be a concern either for the same reason. Sean says, having wet grains, though, would definitely have to be taken into account when designing a recipe. As I think Kai pointed out, that would essentially be conducting a Congress mash, which is basically the gold standard for producing an extremely fermentable wort. Thanks, Sean. Sean says he's close to getting his refractometer formula dialed in, so we'll probably be talking to him in the next few weeks. In the meantime, there's still time to help him with his research. If you have original gravity readings taken with either a refractometer or a hydrometer, then final gravity readings taken with both a hydrometer and a refractometer, send them to Sean. You can find his website at seanterrell.com. And Sean's now a professional brewer, so I hope that we can talk to him about that when we get together as well. Here's an update from Giancarlo in the Philippines. You'll remember he's the one with a friend who wanted to start brewing by growing and malting his own grain and then growing his own hops. Pretty ambitious. Well, Giancarlo says, after several weeks, I convinced my friend that he should first assist me in brewing some extract batches. After many talks and dragging away from the seed shop, he will wait. He seemed really uplifted to hear that he can assist me in extract. Also, the reason that he wanted to go straight to what most brewers would take a very long time to get to is that he hates to order stuff online. Wow. Well, congratulations, Giancarlo. I hope your friend enjoys brewing with you. And I'm sorry for, I think I called you Yawn before. I don't know. Sometimes I try too hard with pronunciations. Bobby writes in after seeing the most recent Basic Brewing video episode where Steve and I played with making a simple cider. Bobby says, I really enjoy watching and listening to your programs. Thanks, Bobby. I was wondering, on the most recent cider making video, when you put the yeast directly in the cider jug, did you use a fermentation lock or did you just put the lid back on? I was wanting to try this little experiment myself and wanted to clarify. I'm assuming you used a fermentation lock that fit on the jug, but I wasn't positive, so I thought I'd ask. Well, good question, Bobby, and one that we will clarify when we shoot a follow-up this week. Do not screw the lid back on the cider jug after you pitch the yeast in there. Do not screw the lid back on the cider jug after you pitch the yeast. You will be creating a potentially explosive situation because the CO2 pressure will build up in there until something gives, either the lid or the jug, or maybe both. Now, I didn't use an airlock. I simply put aluminum foil over the opening of the jug to keep the bugs out. And it worked, as you'll see in the next episode. Lee in Thailand writes with this. He says, firstly, let me say that I'm a big fan of your podcasts. Well, thanks, Lee. They are like an oasis to me here in the homebrew wastelands of Thailand. Sometimes, though, I feel quite envious of all the brews I cannot make. We don't have a homebrew shop. The nearest one is over 1,000 miles away in Singapore. I am looking to you for a bit of advice with a recipe I'm trying to formulate. I have 3 kilograms of Maris Otter, 30 grams of Cascade, Cluster, and Glacier. I'm assuming that's 30 grams each of Cascade, Cluster, and Glacier. Lee says, I would like to use all 3 in 1 ale. Would you please, if you get the time, give it a bit of a think for me? Okay. Now, I'm going to shoot from the hip here since I don't know the alpha acid levels of your hops, but if they're similar, follow this strategy. I think you'll be okay. I've been brewing a lot of nice hoppy pale ales lately, so I'm going to go with that. And since you have 3 kilograms of Maris Otter, I'd go with a 10-liter batch, and that should give you an original gravity around 1068 or so. As far as the hops go, smell your hops and pick the 2 that go together the best, the 2 aromas that pair most nicely, or the 2 that you like the best, and put 1 of those in at 10 minutes before the end of the boil, the whole 30 grams, which is about an ounce, and the other at 5 minutes before the end of the boil. And to get more hop flavor and aroma even, you can even move those additions to 5 minutes and flame out. And you can also add half of each at each of those additions too, to get a blending of those hop characters. You add the third hop in the beginning of the 60-minute boil, and that should give you a nice, super hoppy American pale ale with a Maris Otter sort of backbone. What do you think? What would you do if you were Lee and had those ingredients and wanted to use all of them in one batch of beer? Drop me a line and let me know, and I'll share your comments with Lee. Now, I wrote an article for the current issue of Brew Your Own magazine on alternative lagering strategies, and BYO editor Chris Colby and I chatted about what you can do to chill your brew. Well, Chris Colby, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
We're going to talk about an article by a very talented writer in your magazine this week.
Hack.
Just a little joke, and not much of one. But before we get to that, we should say that we have been getting data from our starch conversion experiment, and that's mm-hmm. a good thing because the deadline is Monday, the last day of the month. So we appreciate everybody who's sent in their data through the form at basicbrewing.com/experiment. And we've even gotten photos as well, which is handy. And make them in handy by the time for the magazine article when that comes out. Mm-hmm. So thanks, everybody. And if you're doing an all-grain batch between now and Monday, keep us in mind and you know, do a starch test with iodine every 5 minutes and send us your results. So very exciting. But we're going to talk about the lagering techniques today. And I wrote the article. if you couldn't catch my poor attempt at a joke earlier, and you guys gave me the assignment of finding sort of alternative lagering methods other than just using a chest freezer and a temperature controller, which seems to be the kind of standby.
Yeah, the sort of gold standard in home brewing is if you can afford and have space for a big chest freezer, you get the chest freezer, you get the external thermostat, and you can pretty much, you know, determine whatever, you know, you can dial in whatever fermentation temperature you want. And so it works great with lagers. If you live in the South like I do, and like you do, sometimes you need it for ales. But, you know, not everyone has room for a chest freezer. Not everyone, you know, has the budget for a chest freezer. And so we're just looking around for, you know, different ways because we know that homebrewers are inventive. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways that they keep their works cool.
And being the resourceful guy that I am and being friends with so many people on Facebook, I went out to our Facebook friends and asked them what they did for their alternative lagering strategies and got a lot of good information. I guess maybe we should start, first of all, I don't want to get into the details of how you make a lager, but I guess we could give the view from 30,000 feet of the fact or why temperature control is so important with lagers.
Yeah, basically, lager brewing differs from ale brewing mostly with regard to the temperature the beer is brewed at. If you're brewing an ale, you know, you typically brew it in the 60s to low 70s Fahrenheit. You know, that's the fermentation temperature from the time you pitch till fermentation is complete. With a lager, typical range, I mean, it's bigger than this in practice, but a lot of them fall into the, you know, 50 to 55 degrees Fahrenheit from, you know, pitching time until the end of fermentation. And then you've got to keep your wort cooler during fermentation and lagering. And there's, because of that, and because the next stage in lager beer brewing is actually lagering, which is lowering the temperature some more and letting the beer condition at cold temperatures, most people don't live in a climate where you have access to, you know, a space that's 55 or, you know, 50 to 55 degrees Fahrenheit, and then later on, you know, 40 degrees Fahrenheit. You know, if you live up north, maybe seasonally you do, but most people don't. And so the article was basically ways to control temperature during lager beer. And we also threw in another part of this is before you pitch your yeast, obviously your wort has been boiling. And so in order to brew a lager, you've got to cool your wort down to lager pitching temperatures. And, you know, we include that in the article too.
Yeah, so most of us, unless you do the no-chill method, and that is probably a minority of brewers out there, but most of us have a way to chill our wort from boiling temperature to ale fermentation temperature in a reasonable amount of time. But say if you live in the South and your tap water is around 80 degrees Fahrenheit in the summertime like it is with here, it's hard to get past ale fermentation temperature and to get down into lager land. So what are some strategies? I mean, how can you get from boiling to lager pitching temperature easily?
Well, there's a couple ways. One way is if you have one way is to add a pre-chiller before your chiller. And this works whether you have a immersion chiller or a counterflow or a plate chiller. Basically, you run there's more than one way to do it, but the easiest way is you run your chill water comes in, goes through the pre-chiller first, then to the chiller, and the pre-chiller is usually an immersion chiller. You put that in a separate, like a bucket or a 5-gallon pot or something like that, and you fill that with ice water. And what happens is the cooling water comes from your tap, goes through the pre-chiller and cools down. So when it hits your chiller, it's colder than tap temperature. And that works very well. And one twist on that is a lot of people, when they do that, at first they'll just chill with tap water till they get to the point where the tap water is not doing any good, and then they'll add the ice water to the pre-chiller because there's no real reason to start melting all your ice when the wort is screaming hot. Your tap water is going to do a good job there. So a pre-chiller is one way to do that. There are some other ways some people will use their immersion chiller, but instead of immersing the chiller in the wort and having water run through it, they'll siphon wort out through their chiller and they'll have it sitting in an ice bath. So the hot wort runs through the chiller, which is, fingers crossed, sanitized at that point. But I think that's a method that might scare some people. But you set, you know, the wort chiller in an ice bath, and it's fairly efficient because, you know, the wort is hot and it's, you know, broken out into just a very long stream. And, you know, there's cold copper tubing right there. And if you sit there and swirl the chiller, you need gloves when you do that or else you'll burn yourself. But swirl it in the cold liquid and have some, you know, reserve ice on hand to keep feeding in there. People have reported that works very well.
Yeah, your point of letting just the regular tap water knock down the initial heat of the wort is a good one, because, you know, even 80 degree Fahrenheit tap water, and that would be around, 26 degrees Celsius, yep, even that will knock off that initial big thermal load of energy from the boiling wort. And then once you get – you'll hit a plateau where the heat is not going to follow off as quickly. And then you can have these alternative strategies to get you past that. But, a very simple way of doing it is to get a big tub and immerse your kettle in ice water. Do an ice bath and keep the wort moving inside the kettle and keep the ice water moving outside of the kettle. And that will get you down to a lower temperature in a fairly reasonable amount of time too.
Yeah, another strategy is to use, if you have an immersion chiller, use your immersion chiller again for the and just and tap water for your initial chilling, then switch to, some people have like a picnic cooler or some big reservoir full of ice water, and then they just pump water through the immersion chiller in a loop. So you've waited till the wort's fairly cool, then you just have a recirculating loop, from an ice bath through the chiller and back to the ice bath. Yeah. And that works for the last little bit.
Yeah, that's what I do. Is I have just a little $20-something pond pump that I got at the hardware store, and I can connect using fittings that I found at the hardware store as well. Connect that pump to the input of the chiller, and then run that ice water through, and then the ice water exits the chiller, goes back into that cooler full of ice water, and so that knocks down. It's not only handy for lagering, but in the summertime, it's handy for ales as well. So you want to make sure that you plug that pump into an electrical socket that is has a ground fault protection thingy on it. You know, they have the little reset buttons so you don't electrocute yourself. You never know. But so once you knock that initial heat out, and you get down to pitching temperature for lagers, now what? I mean, you got to keep the wort cold during that initial fermentation time. And as we said before, the easiest way to do that, or the most common way, is to get a chest freezer of some sort and to hook that into an electronic temperature controller, where you can easily dial the temperature in, and the electronic controller kicks the freezer on and off as it needs to, and the yeast is nice and happy in there. But there are other ways. We talked to Steve Wilkes a couple weeks ago, and he has a little wine refrigerator that he is done fermentation in for his first lager. So that's one way. But we went out to Facebook, and there are people who just live in cold climates who just, you know, it's like they have a cave. It's like they have their own lagering cave. We have people that that talk about their basements and their garages, and some areas of their houses where it just is the perfect lagering temperature. And if you live in a situation like that, you're gold.
Yeah. And additionally, you know, there's a little bit of a tie into history there, in that if you live in a situation like that, you're sort of going to be brewing with the seasons, like, you know, and then that's the way lager brewing initiated. Yeah, a couple things about brewing and, you know, using just ambient cold temperatures to regulate that. Some people live where it's cold enough that they actually have to heat their lagers, mm-hmm. and that's how they maintain the fermentation temperature. Like, some people have a thermostat on, like, an electric blanket, you know, connected to a probe, you know, either touching the side of the carboy or submersed in the wort, and the temperature is, they store the beer somewhere colder, and they rely on heating to keep the lager at the correct temperature, which, of course, to you and I, living where we do, seems incredibly backwards. But because we're struggling to keep ours, you know, cool.
Yeah.
So another way is just straight, using the environmental temperature when the time is appropriate, watching your weather forecasts and knowing, you know, what temperature your basement or your garage outside or different places exist at a steady temperature. And one of the biggest drawbacks to that, I mean, it's certainly the easiest if you look at, you know, your weather report and highs are going to be 55 every day for the next week. You know, and lows, whatever they would be corresponding. You can think, I'm going to go put my, carboy out in the garage, and that can be, you know, and it can work depending on how well buffered the temperature is. If the temperature is really, you know, inside your actual carboy is popping up to, you know, mid-50s and then dropping to mid-20s during, you know, the night, that's not going to be very good. But if it's somewhere where the temperature is, you know, using environmental temperature control in the weather, you're never going to have a rock steady temperature. But if it's somewhere out of, you know, out of the elements and with a little bit of a buffer, you know, as long as the wort is staying, you know, relatively in the same range, which I don't know if I would want to hazard a guess of what, you know, what maximum temperature fluctuation is good or bad. But one thing you definitely can do is at least find out what that temperature variation is. And you can do that by going to a hardware store and getting a high-low thermometer, or sometimes they're called a min-max thermometer. They're just a little, they're very cheap. And, you know, you just put them there, and when you come back and check on them, it shows you, since the last time you checked it, what's the highest and lowest temperature that's been achieved. And then, you know, you reset it. And so those are good if you're going to use environmental, you know, just the environmental temperature to try to brew lagers with, because it gives you some idea of what your, you know, what the temperature variation is. And then beyond that, as some of your Twitter, or at least one of your Twitter guys mentioned, a little bit of actual just lugging the carboy around to different places can keep the temperature. You know, if it's cold in the basement, you know, during the day, but then it gets too cold in the basement at night, you know, maybe lug it up to your kitchen in the morning. And, you know, you can, and people do that. I know people who have, you know, sort of, you know, they know different temperature places in their house, and they just go around and shuffle the carboy there. And, you know, it's
the well-traveled lager.
It's work. And, you know, if you've got a glass carboy, you're carrying around a big thing full of glass, which can be a little nerve-wracking to people. But, yeah. You know, if it's a bucket, it makes it a lot easier from the standpoint of, you know, if you trip and drop it, it's,
yeah,
you know,
it's not going to kill you.
Right. It's probably going to tip over and dump a couple gallons on your floor, but you can right the bucket right away in that. So, environmental temperature control works, but, you know, you're paying for the fact that you're not paying for it.
I got since I wrote the article, I got an email from Mark in Silver Spring, Maryland, who says, "This past holiday season, I started what I hope to be an annual tradition. I use my house as a fermentation chiller." He says, "My wife is from Guatemala, and every year we go down there for the holidays for a couple of weeks. While we are away, the house sits empty. Of course, we don't want to pay the heat to heat the house while we're gone, so we turn the temperature down to 50 degrees Fahrenheit, perfect for primary fermentation for a lager. So this year, 2 days before Christmas, I made a simple lager, and I put the fermenter in a bathtub of water, turned the temperature down to 50 degrees Fahrenheit, and went on vacation for 2 weeks." So
there you go.
If you're really dedicated to your beer, you can put your whole house at the temperature that's appropriate for the beer and just go away. So thanks to Mark for that.
I feel compelled to say something about efficiency and energy usage when we're talking about cooling your whole house down for the carboy.
But. Well, he lives in Silver Spring, Maryland, yeah. So you know that's again, you know, he's heating his house up to 50 degrees. Again, we're not usually used to that. Although, you know, here in Northwest Arkansas, we broke a record this a couple weeks ago, and we got down to like 18 below zero, I think, Fahrenheit.
Wow.
Yeah, which is around minus 27 or something Celsius.
Wow.
That's cold. A friend of mine did the throw a little pan of boiling water up in the air and watch it completely freeze instantly trick. But that's not germane to the conversation. You can also use a tub, and you can alternate ice and heat in that tub of water. Put your fermenter in that tub of water and achieve the same result as having good ambient temperature. And in a way, that may be better because, you know, air surrounding your fermenter can be more volatile than fluid surrounding your fermenter.
Yeah, a lot of people use this method too, where they'll put the carboy in or bucket in, say, a big picnic cooler, or sometimes, you know, those very big sort of got round coolers, they'll put it in there, filled up with water, and then just keep adding ice or keep adding, you know, those little frozen artificial ice deal, you know, and have one set in the freezer at all time and the other set cooling the beer. And that can work very well. I mean, the only your limitation is how often are you monitoring the temperature and changing the ice. And then, of course, that it becomes more and more work the warmer and warmer it is. Mm-hmm. If you're, you know, if your basement is at, say, 60, that's not going to be much work because you're not going to be changing ice that much. But if you're, you know, your house is at 80, you know, it's the middle of summer in the south or something, you're going to be changing ice very, very frequently.
Yeah, I heard from one home brewer who has the large tub in the cold garage and uses an aquarium heater to heat the water again. It's easier sometimes to heat either the water or the environment around the fermenter rather than to chill it down. So the aquarium heater would be good if you hook that up to a temperature control unit. But that was my theory. When I wanted to do lagers here, I wanted to use that system where I immersed the fermenter in a 10-gallon Rubbermaid cooler, which I discovered both a 5-gallon plastic bucket would fit in there and also a 5-gallon glass carboy for secondary fermentation. Both of those fit nicely in a 10-gallon cooler. And I was talking about that with Andy Sparks, and he said, well, you know, it sounds like a lot of trouble because you've got to check it often. And if the temperature fluctuates, you got to add ice or take away ice. And he came up with the idea of adding a second cooler to this system that would have ice water in it, and then using a temperature control unit as you would with a chest freezer, and using the pond pump to regulate the temperature in the cooler where the fermenter is. So when it got too warm, the pond pump would kick on, pump ice water into the cooler with the fermenter, which would return via a hose that connects the two spigots of the chillers of the coolers. So that was the initial design for the low tech lagering system that we talk about here. And it didn't work. It didn't work because the water was coming from the pump faster than it was returning through gravity to the second cooler. So what I did was I wrapped essentially 20 feet of copper tubing around the fermenter in the chiller and ran the cold water through that, and it works great. You do have to change the ice in the second cooler sometimes a couple of times a day depending on what temperature you're at. But there's no worry at all about maintaining the temperature around the fermenter because the electronic controller in the pond pump does that for you. So it sounds cumbersome, but if you don't want to go to the effort or don't have the room or don't have the money to pay for a big old chest freezer, this is one alternative way that you can do it.
Yeah, that's as you said, that, you know, you've built that and tested that and it worked pretty good. I also there's, I don't know if you know about this, there's a winemaker magazine too.
I've heard of that.
Somebody you might know maybe edits that one too. And we had a project in there where this guy built a fermentation and also a storing chiller for white wines. And his was very similar to yours, except he had a big chest freezer. He had an air conditioning unit inside the chest freezer filled with glycol. And then glycol was pumped. And he had almost, I think he had stainless steel wrapping around his fermenter. But, you know, same thing. That would, you know, that could also work. I mean, you've got the problem that now you're working with glycol and not water. And, you know, you certainly need to, if you have any pets, you need to keep that completely. But, you know, and that has more more cooling power, but also probably the, you know, potential to way overshoot your, you know, your target unless you fine tune it a little bit, you know, with working with a thermostat. But yeah, you can, you know, that was the way you devised, and it works well, and sort of fits nicely in between the chest freezer version, you know, which is basically, you know, you just go buy your temperature control and the, you know, methods where you basically, you know, provide the temperature control by, you know, either the environment or by you continually pumping ice in there. And this one was, your project was a nice, you know, middle ground to that, where you have some control, but it's a little bit smaller footprint than a chest freezer and a lot, probably less expensive than a chest freezer, like, mm-hmm. to put that together, assuming, you know, because you probably already had picnic coolers and stuff to start with, so.
Yeah, and you don't have to modify the coolers, so you can use them for a mash tun or for actually going out to a picnic, mm-hmm. because they're not destroyed.
yeah, which would be another thing. Once you have used something to hold glycol, you would want to make sure you cleaned it very well before any food items got in there.
So this was an interesting article to work on because I got to interact with brewers out there and got their ideas on you know, how they do things, and it's really fun to see how different brewers accomplish the same goal through different methods. I mean, everybody's got their own where they live is different. Where they brew is different, where they ferment their beer is different. The equipment that they employ—it's all different, and there's never any one solution fits all for homebrewing. And it's just really, you know, fun and compelling to see what inventive ways that brewers use to solve these situations.
Yeah, homebrewers definitely. When you look at the ways that homebrewers approach different problems are very varied, and it's always interesting to see, the particular solutions that people have hit upon for our common problems.
Sometimes we work too hard, but but again, that's, you know, sometimes that's part of the fun of it. Well, Chris, this has been fun, and I look forward to next week when we get back together and talk about the results of our experiment. Don't forget to buy some iodine or get some iodophore and do some starch testing the next all-grain batch that you do between now and Monday. And hopefully you'll have time to play too this time.
Me? Yes, I think I'm going to. Correct that. I know I'm going to. there's no way I'm going to not do this one.
We will hold you to that.
Okie doke.
Just make up something if it doesn't work out.
You can't do that. Jeez. Don't even say that.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Okay. Talk to you later, James.
Now, obviously, that last comment was a joke. Do not fake your results and send them in, please. We're getting some good stuff already, though. And can't wait to compile it all together. If you want a free issue of Brew Your Own magazine, you can click on the banner ad on basicbrewing.com. And if you subscribe after reading that issue, you'll be helping to support this show. And we appreciate your support very much. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com. Or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from and help me with your name pronunciation if you think I need help. Our newest DVD is in Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, and also our 2011 Brewer's Logbooks are still in stock. They're going limited quantities and quality. No, the quality is unlimited. It's actually a really nice book. Check out our online store for those, and you can also find our other DVDs, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits, too, along with our shirts in the store as well. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com, and if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are My Dead Dad Was in ZZ Top, 100% real, never-before-seen documents from the world of rock and roll. And there's an asterisk after 100% real for some reason. And Victoria 500 Christmas Ideas, celebrate the season in splendor. Well, somebody's getting a head start. Probably a good thing. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. And don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. That's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.